KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand? I'm a paleo
Hey, Ray!
Nerd,
I'm a paleo Hi, Dave. How you doing, man? It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. Well, 30 days, really. We've been doing this monthly, and it's been fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Last time we just talked to each other because we're so mutually fascinating. But
No, we're mutually fascinated with the same subjects.
Well, I guess that's right. But life has been going on. It's raining as per usual. I think we had the wettest November for ever.
Really?
We're ahead of the averages, and
Ketchikan normally gets around what 200 inches of year rain a year.
We're headed for that probably. We just passed 155 or something last
right.
month, so we're well on our way. So
is
here
there,
the last
what's the annual record? What's the record?
Well, I think 200 ish. So
okay.
Yeah, man,
in a year,
go yeah.
Well, it's the first week of December, and I'm in Ojai, Southern California, and it's basically no rain and blue skies.
And you have a new friend in the house.
I have a new friend. I got a brand new dog, Bernie. He's part
Bernie.
Yeah, Bernie.
Don't say his name too. Don't say it too loud, man.
Yeah,
Bernie's right there.
Because the neighbors. Oh, he can't hear me. Bernie is a part Bernese Mountain Dog, Rottweiler, and Lab mix, and he's really kind and gentle and well trained and. I taught him to roll over today. It only took 3 attempts.
Really?
Yeah.
So he's a rescue dog. How
he's
old is Bernie?
Dog. He's a year and a half. So
oh, well, okay.
Hopefully I've got a good decade with him.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the show, Bernie. We might be hearing from him later.
Hopefully
we'll see how
he won't be barking. He'll just lay down and chill out.
Hey, I want you to know that I've been working on my narration chops. I want to kind of be like Morgan Freeman.
Oh.
You know that, where I'm going with that?
Yeah, because you're alluding to Loop. Life on our planet.
Yes, I per your suggestion, I was a naysayer at first. I said, oh, okay, it's on Netflix. Wonderful series, and I finished it last night. And,
oh, fantastic.
I really like how Morgan talks, those dramatic pauses.
Of course. Well, it's, you know, he's God. God talks.
Yeah.
Our previous guest, Dave Marshall, who is the host of PaleoCast, the paleontological podcast that existed before Paleo Nerds, he has connections with the paleontologists and producers and showrunner who, you know, started this project, Life on Our Planet. And his latest podcast, he has something like 30 separate episodes discussing
wow.
ins and outs of each of the, what is it, 8 or 10 part series?
8 shows, yeah. series, so about 8 hours.
So if you want to drill down into the making of, but more essentially the paleontology and research that went in behind the choices they made, they said they had so many different animals they couldn't show, so many ecosystems they wanted to show and they liked to show. But what I loved about this, when they showed a crocodilian from the Permian, they would then show a current crocodile and they would examine the ancient ecosystem and potentially how that animal existed with a current one. So you saw this comparison between extinct animals and extant, which are animals that are
the
not extinct.
Animals. So yeah, they would have examples and basically kind of show you the deep time ancestors or relatives or maybe similar lifestyles. Yeah, it was beautifully shot. And of course, they save a lot of CGI money when they use those, when you use a lot of modern stuff. But
I think the modern stuff was saying this is how a particular dinosaur could have lived by looking at this animal, the same type of ecosystem, same type of niche. You know what I mean?
And there's a lot of predator prey interactions.
Yes.
You know what? I gotta say the paleobotanists got a lot of action in that show.
Yeah.
And they talked about the forest and the plants, but also some of the things that we've talked about, like the Carnian pluvial event. Remember that one? Wait, we actually talked about that. The Carnian pluvial event.
Hold on.
I'm testing you, Dave.
Okay.
It's a previous episode. We talked about it. I am a pluviophile. That's why I live in Ketchikan.
Rain. That's right. Rain in Pangaea, where it rained for like 10, 20 million years.
A couple million years.
Yeah.
And it was in a Triassic. And actually, after this, where it rained around the world for a million plus years, after that, the ecosystem had changed, and that's when dinosaurs kind of rise up.
Right. Well, the invention of the umbrella.
The Bumbershootosaurus.
Yeah,
I like that one.
Yeah. And you know what? The other cool thing is that the CGI of the dinosaurs that they depicted is the best and finest to date as far as realism and paleontologically accurate. I was just blown away.
Yeah, I thought it was great. But being the true paleo nerd, there's all these creatures I really wanted to see. So maybe you and I will be called in as consulting experts someday, Dave. That's my dream. They'll do everything we want. Come on. We know enough.
I have 1 year of college, and I've read 1,000 books. So.
Well, we can play with the big boys, the big adults.
You can, Ray. I defer to you.
You defer? All right.
So today we have an amazing guest, and we've kind of talked about this subject and location several times in the past, but we're drilling down into something that I've been asking you. I've been saying, Ray, I want to talk mosasaurs and marine reptiles.
You mentioned mosasaurs a few weeks ago, and I went to the guy who knows mosasaurs, but also knows how to talk to the general public. He's an amazing, dynamic, just encyclopedia of everything that happened in the Western Interior Seaway, the WIS that once dominated the Cretaceous North America, split America in two. Mike is the author of many, many papers. We're talking about Mike Everhart. I'm really looking forward to talking to Mike.
Yeah, well, let's get on the old paleo phone and give him a ring.
What does the paleo phone sound like, Dave? Does it sound like... Oh, I like that. Hey, Dave, meet Mike Everhart. He's an adjunct curator of paleontology at the Sternberg Museum in Hayes, Kansas, and author of the book Oceans of Kansas, and co-author of the latest edition of The Roadside Geology of Kansas. It is so good to have you here with us on Paleo Nerds, Mike. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Hey, appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it's nice to meet you, Mike. The question is, and we ask all our guests, are you a paleo nerd, and when did it start? You must be.
Well, yeah, obviously I'm deep into paleo, but really it started back in the fifth grade when I had a teacher that was a rock hound at the time, and she took me as a student to a gem and mineral show, and after that it's history. we went into it pretty strongly after that.
You mentioned in one of your interviews that it was the book by Roy Chapman Andrews that kind of got you going in a way too, right?
Yeah, about the same time, I don't know. It was at 12, 13 years old. I had a book called All About Dinosaurs, and mostly about dinosaurs in Mongolia that Roy Chapman Andrews was famous for discovering. But there were also two chapters in that book about Kansas marine fossils.
Ah.
Talked about mosasaurs and plesiosaurs and pteranodon. And after that, I had to go see. And it took me several years, but I got out to the Sternberg Museum and then had a geology class or paleontology class in college that we had a field trip out there, and I collected my first fish bones and shark tooth and things like that.
But why marine reptiles rather than, you know, the classic Tyrannosaurus rex? And
well, we don't have very many dinosaurs here in Kansas, and the ones that we do have either drowned here or died someplace else in war.
Isn't that the famous Nodosaur?
Yeah, Nibrosaurus. But actually,
which is
the
kind
first
of like
dinosaur,
an Ankylosaurus, which what that was a float and bloat, they think, or
float and bloat. The first one that was found here was by O.C. Marsh back in 1871.
Oh, that's
it was
right.
Actually, a small hadrosaur called Cliosaurus.
Oh,
and
That ended up back in Pennsylvania,
I ended up back in Connecticut, in New Haven.
Connecticut, all right.
Peabody Museum of Natural History. They went up on the wall and it's been there ever since. So very few people in Kansas know anything about it. But, yeah, that was
your interest was really a local thing because you were living in Kansas. That was where the fossils were basically in your backyard. That's why you really went.
Yeah, I was fascinated with the idea that we had marine fossils in the western part of the state. I actually, started collecting shells, I guess, and petrified wood. And then about 1964 or so, I found my first mammoth tooth in a sand pit. And, I got fascinated with the fossils and what they meant and how old they were and, cool.
Well, I kind of share a little bit of the similar history in that I came to Kansas in 1968, ended up going to high school there. But I had also read Roy Chapman Andrews' books as a kid, and I was already a dinosaur fanatic, and I landed in Kansas. And then in high school and college, I finally had the opportunity to get out to western Kansas and borrowed a car to get out there and had to go to the fossil fields, went to the Sternberg. And it really wasn't until I came back to Kansas in 92 and hooked up with Chuck Bonner that I finally got to go out into where the fossils really were. And then that just really did it for me. And as you know, I've been drawing a lot of this stuff, but and I've consulted your books. But anyways, we should probably dive into A Sea Full of Monsters. Shall we do that? Listening to one of your lectures, and you were saying, we always talk about the great age of dinosaurs, and you said, really, they're all crowded up on land, and we really ought to call it the great age of marine reptiles. And why is that? Why is that?
Well, for one thing, in the Mesozoic, the sea levels were changed a lot, but at least during the Cretaceous, the oceans covered 85% or so of the Earth. And so all of the dinosaurs that we celebrate were crowded onto 15% of our land area. So the ocean's a huge place, and we had all kinds of marine reptiles from the beginning of the Triassic onward on through the end of the Cretaceous. Huge plesiosaurs, ichthyosaurs that died out before mosasaurs, and then the Johnny-come-lately mosasaurs that didn't get here until the early Cretaceous, and then they took over the world. These were amazing animals, and at some points ever been as big as maybe everything but the very largest sauropods on land.
When did the marine reptiles first appear in the fossil record?
The first ones are the ichthyosaurs in the Triassic, early Triassic, and they're followed very shortly by the first plesiosaurs in the later Triassic.
And the plesiosaurs had the very long neck, right?
They didn't have the long necks until very late. I mean, the longest ones, of course, here in Kansas, and there's a newer one up in
What is the evolutionary adaptation that would allow the early ones to have fairly short, stubby necks and then the elongated ones?
The question, I suppose, is why did they have such a long neck? And the only thing we can figure out is that it allowed these animals to swim up under a school of fish in the dark zone and be invisible, more or less, and then reach their neck and their jaws up into the school and, begin feeding.
Well, I was going to say, the long necks, there's the plesiosaurs, and within the plesiosaurs, there's the pliosaurs, the short-necked plesiosaurs, and then there's the elasmosaurs, which have the elaborately long necks. They're crazy long. And then there's the polychaetylids, I guess, too, right?
Easy for you to say.
Yeah,
easily. Polychaetylid. Hey, hold on.
Well, that's another short-necked plesiosaur. But the main question I really want to put to Mike here is, if you have a plesiosaur neck up out of the water and you've drawn it that way, it's wrong. And I've been doing that all my life, Mike. Yeah. And so I sit here embarrassed. Why is that? And I want to push back maybe a little bit.
They were air breathers. All marine reptiles were air breathers.
Yeah. And they had to raise their head above water to breathe, but that's all they raised above water. They simply didn't, the neck wasn't flexible enough to come up like a swan. Right. And sit there, but they're also, to do that, they'd also have to defy gravity. I mean, you can go in a swimming pool and try to lift a board out you know, in front of you, simulating a long neck, and trying to lift it into the air, it keeps coming down. It'll keep pulling you down because when you're in the water, you're supported. You're more or less weightless. Anything brought out of the water, the neck and head would weigh something, and you can't do it. The other thing is a lot of the early plesiosaur pictures show this snake-like neck, and in fact, I think Cope even referred to them having a snake-like neck that could reach up and grab pteranodons out of the air and things like that. But
right. Or the Loch Ness Monster.
Right.
The famous picture of the Loch Ness Monster, they say
exactly.
Was a plesiosaur. Which
but if you look at the vertebra, they look like spools. They're stacked together and end to end like that, and there's no flexibility in them, except maybe in the last 4 or 5 feet of the neck behind the head, there would have been a little flexibility. But the long neck itself was just simply held out in front of the animal.
It was rigid, huh?
Wow. And the other thing you get into when you start moving that neck around in the water, that's a perfect rudder. I mean, it'll literally turn your animal as he's swimming. He can't swim in a straight line and put his neck out to the side.
Oh, that's interesting. Real quick for our listeners, just describe the marine reptiles that existed in the late Cretaceous. So as far as what do they look like and their basic names? And don't give me the what did you say, Ray?
Polychaetylids.
Polychaetylids.
Yeah. Well, so let's start. A mosasaur looks like a giant marine lizard, basically.
Yeah, a Komodo dragon with flippers in place of feet.
Great.
And they're really very close to that.
Yeah, yeah.
And they swim with their tails. Fairly flexible skull, but the analogy that Cope uses is that lower jaw, they could literally pull it back because of the joints at your elbows. It literally flexed back like this. So once they grab something, they didn't tear things up. They grabbed them whole and just basically ratcheted them back into the throat to swallow them.
Like the way a snake does, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And the skull is very similar. Well, snakes and mosasaurs and Komodo dragons are all in the same group.
If we're going to be talking about mosasaurs really quickly here, that forked tongue, do they have a forked tongue?
More than likely. I mean, we can't tell, but from what we can see of their nervous system and the way that the nerves come through the jaw, lower jaw, it's the same as what we see in the lizards today.
First species of sea snakes have forked tongues, and they are completely ocean-going. Mm-hmm. I did my little research on that one. So there is an extant example.
Yeah, the only question is whether it's actually usable or not. You know, in the air, I mean, it senses,
right.
You know, the water is full of all kinds of things. So,
yeah, right.
So that's still a question, but undoubtedly they still had a forked tongue.
Right.
Well, since we're drilling down on mosasaurs here a bit, the relationship with monitor lizards, Komodo dragons, and snakes, and that jaw structure that you're talking about, I loved reading the book. We're talking about how it ratcheted things back. You said, try extending your arms out in front of you, and then the only way to really bring something back to you is you've got to flex your elbows.
Yeah.
So you're literally pulling something, the prey back in, because they also had an extra set of teeth on their palate. What are those called? The
pterygoid
teeth.
And that's spelled P-T-E-R.
Yeah. And like everything else in paleontology.
Yeah, Y-G-O-I-D. Yeah, pterygoid.
Hinging jaw, that lower jaw, also allow for you to swallow bigger things like a snake?
Yeah, exactly. We've got pretty good evidence with a specimen that Charlie Sternberg found in 1918 or so that included a medium-sized plesiosaur, polychaetylid, as stomach contents. And so it's more than likely it was swallowed pretty much whole and partially digested by the time the mosasaur died for whatever reason. They didn't chew their food, and they weren't.
Yeah.
Most of them had conical teeth. They're not tearing teeth like sharks. So they weren't really capable of tearing things up the way that you envision a shark biting a chunk out of something.
They had to swallow it whole. But I know there's been conjecture as to, do they have a common ancestor with monitor lizards and snakes, or did snakes, what's the relationship there?
I think the three groups had a common ancestor, but that's unclear. I was able to describe a very early mosasaur vertebra from here in Kansas that would have put their beginnings back about 100 million years. But they were land-dwelling lizards or shore-dwelling lizards at that point. And like marine iguanas are today, they live on the land and they go into the ocean to feed.
Right, right.
Well, in the mosasaur's cases, they took it one step further. They stayed in the ocean. They began to adapt in various ways. And one of those ways is giving live birth to their young. Williston was very sure that somehow mosasaurs drug themselves up on the beach someplace like a turtle and laid eggs. But that just simply didn't happen. One, their skeletons, by the time they evolved into what we consider to be the mosasaur body plan today, they just simply didn't have the strength to move on land.
Is there any evidence of live birth? Don't they have evidence of ichthyosaur live birth?
Certainly. They've got very good evidence of that.
Yeah, so is there the same similar evidence of mosasaur live birth?
The Schoenhofen shale or limestone in Germany has got several instances where they actually have a mother ichthyosaur in the process of giving birth. The babies are leaving the mother when right. She died and was preserved on the bottom, and so they've got that. And we've got one plesiosaur from Kansas, a polychaetylid, that Bonner family actually found.
Yes, in Los Angeles, yeah.
Right, includes a smaller individual. And there's some contention whether that was a single baby or that was, you know, something associated with that the plesiosaur. But but yeah, there's no doubt that they gave live birth to.
Wow.
What about the mosasaurs? Is there evidence of a mosasaur with?
Yes, yes. One, we find baby mosasaur bones out there. But in South Dakota, there is a plow-plated carpus specimen that I actually helped dig on. That had
the remains.
Yeah. Yeah, it's related to what we have here in Kansas, only more evolved, you know, years later from the Pierre Shale. But it had the remains of five babies inside.
Wow. Okay. So did they come out head first?
I assume they did, but the remains weren't that complete. We had, you know, the thing had been scavenged by sharks, but they found at least five of the quadrate bones from small mosasaurs inside the body of the mother, and, you know, basically assumed that was it. For some reason, that paper, you know, I knew about it in the 1990s, and it never got published, and I still don't understand why, but I was there, and I saw the evidence, so.
A mosasaur, though, is the largest marine reptile, right?
Mm-hmm. No.
No.
Probably an ichthyosaur.
Yeah.
But the big pliosaurs were also huge.
Diplurodon. Let me rephrase that. The largest marine lizard reptile?
Well, it would be the largest marine lizard. We can't group ichthyosaurs or plesiosaurs with mosasaurs.
Right.
They're completely different,
right.
Separate kinds of reptile.
Okay. Okay, back to the, you pointed a moth.
I'm going to take
a photo of this, so I'm going to take a screenshot right now. You're holding and Mike, why don't you just go like that with your finger, Mike, because I'm going to.
One of my unfavorite mosasaur characters.
Yeah, I just took that photo. So that has a tail that is vertical, like a
shark-like tail.
Shark.
Yeah. So let me just jump in before we pose it to Mike, in that when animals return to the ocean, when we've got vertebrates that go back to the oceans, their limbs become fins. Basically, we see that in the mosasaurs and the ichthyosaurs. But the longer period of time that they stay in the ocean, they get more streamlined. And there's been a lot of debate as to whether or not mosasaurs had a kind of ichthyosaur style of tail, more of a tail fluke. Mm-hmm. And I know I have seen some fossils that have some beautifully preserved skin, and as you've dug on these fossils that have actually the scales, these minute scales of mosasaurs. But I know you have some strong feelings about this. What do you think about that tail fluke?
There's exactly one specimen in the world from Lebanon of a mosasaur, a mosasaur. With a tail, what looks like a tail fluke, and it's basically a lighter area preserved in the matrix around the vertebra. Around
looks
the
like organic vertebra. Material.
It could, yeah, you could interpret it. I think that's been interpreted that way. But there's no bone structure. There's no nothing that there's nothing extending off of the tops of the dorsal vertebra, the caudal vertebra there. Okay, I'll accept that one specimen. But
what about the two choices are just a regular lizard-like tail or an actual swimming fluke is what you're posing
yeah.
here, right?
Well, they were envisioned, or I've envisioned them as having a broad, flat tail that swim back and forth. And there's the other contention there is there's a downturn in the tail.
Right.
And that's where they put this fluke all the time. Well, okay. That can be documented. That can be measured and has been. So that is real. But the other contention, other suggestion on that is that when you look at the force of moving this tail back and forth, and the idea that it is also producing a downward force, not only just a side-to-side to move forward, but a downward force to keep the animal's head above water. So there's some issues there that downward force over the life of a mosasaur, 20, 30 years, whatever it is, would also tend to deform the vertebra, and actually what they call keystone them, in such a way as to turn the tail downward. Okay, that's another explanation.
Are these skeletons found with the tail kinked downward?
Oh, yeah, that's a fact.
That's not some sort of a death pose.
No, but it's...
The bones are shaped that way, but...
It's really pretty minimal. It's only a few degrees over a series of four or five vertebrae, and then it straightens out again. In ichthyosaurs, if you look at some of the evidence in Europe, as an ichthyosaur... in this particular species, and I don't have the species off the top of my head, they've got a whole life series of these, growth series of ichthyosaurs. And as the ichthyosaur ages, the tail vertebra turn downward, and the tail fluke gets bigger.
So it's the lifetime of an animal, not of an evolutionary...
Right. Well, and the animal gets bigger, and you know he needs needs more thrust back there or something over time. But the tail gets actually bigger, and the downturn gets bigger. So, until we find something with much better information, we don't know.
I got to say, I love these kind of discussions and arguments in the mosasaur world and in the paleo world. But now we had a previous guest, Louise Chappett, at the LA County Museum, and there's that specimen that Marion Bonner, I think, dug up that. Is on display there at the museum, and he was part of the paper on this tail fluke.
Robin O'Keefe and Chiappi did it. Yeah,
so that's got a fluke too. Apparently,
about what has a fluke. What are you talking about?
It's got the tail.
That's a polychaetylid plesiosaur.
Okay,
it didn't have a tail. Well, we don't know about. Plesiosaurs. I see sometimes they recreate them with a tail fluke, but there's nothing in their vertebra that suggests that they were wagging their tail. Although they were flying through the water with the paddles.
Right.
Speaking
of paddles, the front and rear limbs, when I look at the skeletons, they show five distinct digits. I mean, very long, distinct digits. Yet reconstructions show paddles. Was there any indication of finger movement within the paddle, or were these paddles rigid? I mean,
it depends on the mosasaur or on the plesiosaur. In the plesiosaurs, there's no evidence of movement. But when you get into mosasaurs like Tylosaurus that have a skeleton that is really cartilaginous, you see a separation in those things.
Yeah.
And it seems like they did have kind of a webbed paddle.
Right.
Now, I don't know what that means, individual movement, but they at least had webbing. And I've seen a specimen up at KU that has, you can see the webbing between the toes.
Right.
But that may have been a little different. And Tylosaurus, as big as he is a fairly old and primitive mosasaur, or an early mosasaur.
Right.
And they may have been doing something with a little different with those paddles, as opposed to the later mosasaurs like Mosasaurus and Pleiopleiocarpus that had paddles that were pretty solid. All the way to the end, and there's some evidence that Plotosaurus in California was actually becoming more ichthyosaur-like with its paddles and actually starting to to fly through the water with the paddles rather than right. just hold it back against their sides. And
that's what a like Pleurodon fly through the water with alternating paddles. There's a the rear and the front paddles are the same size, and they
pretty much the same size,
and they fly rather than
right
paddle, I guess.
Right, that was, you know, initially you see some of the reconstructions, particularly with long neck elasmosaurs, with these flippers that are duck-like paddles or something. They're paddling their way through the water, and that's there's no.
I saw this in Walking with Dinosaurs is where I first saw the flying through the water, the Liplurodon.
Yeah. Well, before we turn to the short-neck pliosaurs, I just was wondering before we leave the mosasaur story there. How big do they get, Mike?
Well, don't watch Jurassic World. Oh,
was that eating a great white? Was that the mosasaur?
Mosasaur is jumping out
coming
of
the up out of the pool.
In front
about
of the crowd, 100
feet
right.
long. No, the maximum we've got, and we've got skeletal evidence for them, particularly in Europe, is that the biggest Tylosaurus or biggest Mosasaurus may have reached 60 or 65 feet.
Wow.
These things grew through their entire life, very slow, much slower at the end, but they, once they were no longer subject to being eaten by somebody else, they just continued to grow. And a few of them got very, very large.
Wow. So bigger than a school bus. Yeah, 65 feet.
60 or 60 feet. 60,
but you say Europe, so they were worldwide and all the seas worldwide that we know?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
All these marine reptiles were in all the oceans?
Yep.
Not just the interior seaway?
No. The interior seaway was a sideshow, more or less. Although there's some evidence that a lot of them may have evolved here and spread outward. Through the Gulf of Mexico.
There is that new screw tooth one from Morocco. It's got the strange teeth.
Wait, I looked that up, Ray. I couldn't see what you meant by screw tooth.
Stelodons.
I looked that up on Wikipedia, and I didn't seem to see anything.
Are you Googling that right now? It's from Morocco, and there was a paper on it earlier this year.
I looked at
it
earlier in my exhaustive research on Mike's
book.
Turns out it's a screwdriver-shaped tooth, not a screw-toothed. So there you go. Put that in your toolbox.
Certainly by the end of the Cretaceous, mosasaurs were doing all kinds of crazy things, and you've got one
out of Globidens.
Yeah.
Globidens. He was a clam eater.
Yeah. And then you've got some with blade-like teeth that look like shark teeth. And you've got Gogosaurus or something down from Africa that looks more like a crocodile. He's actually got incisors up front that interlock
really
on the outside of the jaws.
A mosasaur? And,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a mosasaur. Yeah.
Wow.
But not very many of them. But they were found. Or it was found in Africa. So they're experimenting. I think Mike Paulsian has got some stuff off the coast of Africa recently. Here, that's been at the Smithsonian and so on. All kinds of diversity spreading everywhere, and then bang at the end, you know, the oceans die, and so do the mosasaurs.
Well, did they replace the pliosaurs? That's the short neck. There's a good segue there. So the big short neck, like Liopleurodon, and I want to get to the story of Brachycineus becoming Megacephalosaurus.
Okay. So, wait. Hold on a second. So, is there a time difference between pliosaurs and mosasaurs?
No.
Yeah.
They existed at the same time.
They overlap here in Kansas by about 2 million years. Megacephalosaurus and the early Tylosaurus and Pediocarpus mosasaurs, when they were much smaller, it's likely they were subject to predation from Megacephalosaurus. So there's about a 2 million year window in there where they'd have been the little guys on the block, but then the Megacephalosaurus died off and went extinct, and Mosasaurus just blossomed.
Was a Megacephalosaurus a pliosaur?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a big pliosaur.
Great. Well, a plesiosaurus with a short neck.
Yes.
A big head with a short neck,
Let me set this up a little bit here. Brachycineus lucasii. When I first visited the Sternberg Museum, there's this massive skull that's on display there. It's 5 feet long, almost 5 feet long.
Right.
And it was dubbed Brachycoenus, and I went to town drawing all these big pliosaurs in there with the mosasaurs. As we said, they overlapped. But then years later, you get to looking at that skull, and I've done all these drawings calling it Brachycoenus, and then you looked at it closer, Bruce Schumacher worked with you, and you realized it had to be a different genus, and there was even bigger skulls out there. Can you give us a little bit of that?
Well, a lot of things happened. One, it was never really positively identified as Brachycoenus. The type skull, type species of Brachycoenus also comes from Kansas.
We're talking about mosasaur here, right?
No, we're pliosaurs.
Well, you guys are jumping between reptiles here.
There was a segue there. So the pliosaurs, which is a type of plesiosaur, is replaced by the mosasaurs.
Okay. Right.
So go ahead.
Okay. The original Brachycoenus was dug up by Charlie Sternberg and sent to Marsh back in the 1890s. Ended up in the Smithsonian. And that was the one and only that we knew about from Kansas. And then in 1950, a couple of shark tooth hunters in Russell County came across this big 5-foot skull in Russell County. And they notified George Sternberg. And he went out and dug it up. And actually, in his notes, he thought it was a big mosasaur at the time. But it's down in the Fairport Chalk. It's too early, really, for a big guy. But anyway, it sat in our museum. He prepared it and put it on display, actually cleaned it up on both sides, and then put it into plaster. So the mouth parts, the palate of that skull, was not visible from that point on, from the 1950s on. I found some photographs. George Sternberg was also a photographer, and he documented some of his work in good photography, and I found a photograph of the palate of the skull, black and white photograph, and showed it to Bruce Schumacher, and he said, whoa, this is different. This is not Brachycoenus. So we got permission to take the skull out of the plaster tomb and clean it up and cast it and be able to examine the thing to the details that we needed. In the meantime, I found parts of a larger skull up at the University of Nebraska in their museum that had been dug up in northern Kansas, I don't know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, put in a museum tray and forgotten. But it turns out it's about 25% larger than this. It's not a complete skull, but the jaws indicate it would have been 25% larger. So that's cool, and we ended up being able to sell that as a new genus and species of pliosaur.
Megacephalosaurus, easily as big as Lyoplerodon, isn't it?
No, I think you're talking Lyoplerodon. You're talking 7, 8, 9 foot jaw.
It
was also Jurassic in age from Europe. Kind of an indication that pliosaurs started a decline in numbers and size from the Jurassic on through the first half of the Cretaceous. They were actually went extinct right at the beginning of the late Cretaceous.
Only to be replaced. Enter the mosasaur.
I have a question about the Western Interior Seaway. When did it begin? Was it mid-Cretaceous and lasted for like 10, 20 million years?
Probably right at the beginning of the early Cretaceous, and by beginning, I mean, Kansas was dry at the time, through the end of Jurassic. It was kind of a barren wasteland out here. We have no Jurassic or Triassic rocks in the state. There was literally no deposition going on, so it was hot, dry, and eroding.
Talking 145 million years ago is the Jurassic Cretaceous boundary.
Okay, so toward the end of the early, at some point in there, what you have is the Rocky Mountains are beginning to uplift through Western North America, and that's creating a flex in the crust of the middle of North America. So you have the Seaway coming down from Canada and coming back up from the Gulf of Mexico and eventually meeting over Kansas about 110 million years ago. We're not really sure, but that's the Kiowa Formation.
So that's, mid-Cretaceous, right?
Right. Well, it would be the middle of the Cretaceous. that's, you know, a shallow, muddy sea, but it's got all kinds of sea life, including plesiosaurs, the other fish and turtles. And then that gives way to a broader, deeper expanse of the Western Seaway, beginning with the late Cretaceous, that about 100 million years ago.
Would it be about 500 miles wide at its widest? And
yeah,
how deep?
That'd probably be a good guess. Yeah, well, it would depend. It flexes. That's the other thing that's going on, is sea levels were up and down during that time period. And there's actually a paper out that says the evolution of some of the Triceratopsian dinosaurs in Montana was driven by the fact that the sea levels would shrink, and they had all this land to come out on and evolve, and then the sea levels would go wide again and drown out a big portion of the population, basically driving the evolution of them, and probably hadrosaurs along the seaway there. But in Kansas, you know, it was mostly just a matter of getting deeper or shallower during those times, because it pretty much covered Kansas during most of the late Cretaceous.
Right. Right. There was an anoxic event in the late Cretaceous. What caused that?
The bottom was almost, apparently, during the deposition of chalk, was almost always anoxic. Very few creatures capable of living down there because of the low oxygen.
Right.
So we always dealt with that. But the upper surface was sunlit, clear water, full of diatoms and other, you know, fossils that are algae that are both producing oxygen and producing the basic level of food source for everything else in the ocean. So you've got all of these things combining to make the seaway very rich and plentiful in life forms, and a lot of evolution going on during that time.
And they die off to become all the layers of chalk.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. Billions and billions,
billions,
to use Carl Sagan's analogy there, of these tiny little microscopic shells settling down to the bottom. And not only creating the chalk, but also creating the situation that preserves these fossils, including mosasaur skin, things like that, very, very well over time.
It's funny, when you see the Great White Cliffs of Dover and you see how large they are, it gives you an incredible impression of that is all, that's the same thing we're talking about.
Well, that's the thing, when you get out to Western Kansas, it's stunning. You're driving along as wheat fields, and then suddenly when you get into the Badlands there, it is, chalk. And basically the chalk rock is ancient plankton, just piles and piles of ancient plankton.
Well,
but
algae,
Algae, coccolithophores.
Coccolithophores, Ethiphyuthiphae.
Yeah, the shells, calcium carbonate.
Yeah.
The neat thing about England is you get to see that vertical exposure. There's no place in Kansas that you can see it. And we've got 600 foot of chalk here, too.
Right.
Well, the Monument Rocks in the Jerusalem Rock State Park is pretty impressive, the cliffs that are there, but made of the chalk. But one of the things I've always wondered about, and I'm holding up a pteranodon here.
Oh, we're going to get into flying reptiles.
I wanted to ask about this, because we have this this shallow sea that's about 500 miles wide, expands and contracts.
Maximum over Kansas was probably about 600, but as you go farther east, it's more than likely it's shallowed out fairly rapidly toward the eastern part of the state.
Right.
But as you get to Colorado, then you've got this geological foreland deep that may have been a couple of thousand foot deep there.
Ooh,
in front of the
Oh, I didn't know that the western side of the WIS was that deep.
Yeah, well, again, it's geological in nature, but as the mountains were uplifted, the crust folded away from the collision, and you get this deep area up close.
Oh.
And, you know, that's where some of our natural gas fields, the Hugoton natural gas field, and some of the other big deposits, well, helium and other things.
Isn't that where the giant Inoceramus clams come from?
There's some 9-foot-long shells of Inoceramus there against the Rocky Mountain front range there.
Okay. And Ray's holding up this bird. You're itching to talk about this. Sorry.
Okay.
Not a bird. All right. This flying reptile.
This is a pteranodon, a pterodactyl, a pterosaur. And so we have this wide, expansive, shallow sea. But yet, there in the middle of Kansas, we have these beautifully preserved pterosaurs. We have pteranodon, and we have nyctosaurus, which is a crazy-looking beast unto itself, which I do want to ask you about that. But what are they doing out there in the middle of the ocean? These are very lightly boned creatures.
They're eating.
Can we imagine?
What do you mean they're doing? They're eating.
Well, let me How do they eat, Dave? Are they sitting on the surface of the ocean?
Right.
Are they dabbling? Are they skimming? Because it takes, you have to have a weirdly shaped jaw to skim. Are they diving down? But are they capable? Do you think they were capable of actually kind of sitting on the surface? And what's their lifestyle?
That's one of the pressing questions of our time. We don't know. Now, based on their stomach contents, we know they ate small fish. And we have several examples of that, along with birds like Hesperornis and so on. But how they were doing it is a real interesting question, because that, as you mentioned, that beak is so lightly constructed. I can't imagine them skimming it through the water and ramming into a fish. I've never seen a pterosaur beak that's damaged.
Right.
Oh.
And I've got one here that, the end of the beak, it comes out to almost a needle point. It's like the sharp end of a pencil.
It's crazy. But so
how big were the pterosaurs?
25, 30 foot wingspan.
That's the biggest male.
You mean these are the Quetzalcoatls?
It's pronounced Quetzalcoatlus, not Quetzalcoatlus.
It's pterosaurs, pterodactyl, pteranodon.
Well, hold on. Tell me, I'm a newbie here. Tell me the difference between these giant Quetzalcoatlus. That's not a pterosaur, that's a pterodon.
It is a pterosaur.
Okay, pteranodon is the genus and species, or the genus name, of a large marine reptile found first here in Kansas in 1870 by
flying reptile.
Flying reptile by Marsh on his expeditions out here. Sometime later, they also discovered the
lost Nyctosaurus.
Nyctosaurus. Which has about an 8-foot wingspread maximum. These are, this is only about a 6 or 8 million year period during the late Cretaceous, when those were the dominant species over the Western Interior Seaway. We don't see anything else.
How many different flying reptiles were there as far as?
Around the world.
No, in the Western Interior Seaway.
Just two.
Oh.
We're only looking at a very short period geologically, 6-8 million years.
Sure.
And they were the dominant species here. We don't see anything else. And they were and the other thing, they were the only ones that are flying over the Western Interior Seaway in numbers enough to fall and die and be preserved here. We don't know what was going on the land. And there were certainly other pterosaurs there adapted to feeding on insects and other prey.
But these are animals that died out to sea and
but that's what I'm asking about. How did they end up out in the ocean like that? Yeah. So they were either feeding, or they were blown down, or they simply fell out of the sky and died. But what I did, and one of this big chalk drawing that I did when I just went back and I worked in the Planet Ocean book, which ended up being an exhibit, I talked to Chris Bennett, right? I think.
Mm-hmm. Chris, yeah.
Chris, who said, it's okay, Ray, if you draw. He is a pterosaur expert and did his PhD, I think, in Pteranodon.
Yeah, he did.
And so I asked him, could I draw them actually swimming? Could they be at the surface? They've dove down into the water.
Like a cormorant, you mean?
Well, like a seagull sitting out there in the ocean. Right. And so in that image, I dared to draw them swimming around. So once again, I've got my plesiosaurs with their necks out of the water, but I've also got pteranodons swimming because I like to break the rules. So,
well, we don't know what the rules are here. It's quite possible there are all kinds of marine birds today that dive into the water or somehow underwater. They may just stick he may have floated on the surface and just stuck that big head under the water.
Yeah, that's kind of what I envisioned.
We had huge schools of fish, bait balls, like you do in modern oceans. And it may have just been simple to land in the middle of one of those and, fill your mouth. I don't see them diving into the water. They're simply too lightly constructed.
Right. Nyctosaurus is a crazy one.
Yeah, it's a flying, flying reptile.
It is a pterosaur. And Nyctosaurus is the genus name.
It has amazing pole sticking up out of its head. And then another one coming out kind of the back of the pole. Almost like a fork from the side.
Yeah, like a sail almost. Like it's a T-shape. Yeah.
And
an L-shape.
What do you think would be the evolutionary reason for that?
Well, again, like the single specimen of a mosasaur with a tail fluke. We've only got two of these skulls of nyctosaurs
with
a fancy stick out there.
Are they broken or are they completely intact?
they're pretty much intact. One of them is broken. One of them is perfect almost.
Right.
But they were found by the same guy in the same part of the county out there. And so, you know, and it ended up in a private collection. And so, you know, Chris Bennett was able to photograph them, but because they're not publicly available, he was.
Oh, they're not.
No. They're on display, but they're not available.
Some guy's living room.
Well, a little museum down at Brazos, Texas, I think, but the last I saw. But again, there's some question about whether they're available for other researchers to study. And I know the guy that collected them. I've seen his work. I trust him real well. But it's hard to explain the coincidences that, you know, after all this time, and we've got several dozen nictosaur specimens, partly complete. This guy all of a sudden finds two more with these funny crests.
Crazy.
Are you saying it's possible that could be made up?
I don't think it's possible, but that's always going to be a question until, you know, we can get in there and somebody examine them with X-ray material,
right,
or other, you know, all the technology that we've got today that we didn't have.
So
back
these
when
could
they
be faked then.
Again, I don't think so, but but anything is possible,
right,
I suppose.
Oh, yeah, well.
But there's been several dozen of these things found since the 1870s.
Right.
And a fairly complete specimen. There's a nice one up at the University of Nebraska.
And there's no head crest.
And there's no head, there's some things. But the other thing that we know about in pterosaurs in general is that it was only the males that had these big honking crests. Pteranodon longiceps that was discovered here first in the 1870s got the big males have got a huge triangular crest off the back of the skull.
Right.
The females don't have a crest. Even the juveniles, and my wife found a juvenile Pteranodon longiceps skull. It doesn't have a crest, but it's fairly large. It's too big to be a female, but it's not old enough or mature enough.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That it developed sexually or whatever to the point that it developed this sexual display, if you will.
Is there obvious sexual dimorphism besides?
Well, that's the only reason, you know, the only reason we can think of.
Right.
And that occurs fairly, you know, commonly in male birds and various other animals. That's, you know, it's competition sort of thing. My crest is bigger than yours, so there.
My first vertebrate fossil that I found with Chuck Bonner when I was out on the land with him looking at my first real fossil hunt with somebody who knew what they're doing was a Pteranodon. So just going into a gully.
Cool. What did you find?
It was a leg bone basically sticking out of the side of the chalk. And I said, what's this? And Chuck said, well, I think you found a pterosaur. Pteranodon. And it went into the cliff, and it kind of stopped at about the hip bone, and that was it. There's a lot of the skeletal material out there is like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, Pteranodon bone is hollow to begin with. It's like two layers of cardstock. When you dig it, it's all flattened together and fractured and really difficult to...
Also, very little deposition will cause these bones to...
Oh, yeah. Erosion eats them up.
Right.
You know, in life, they were hollow. They had struts. Bone struts in the interior
for strength.
They're basically inflated. The Pteranodon long system had tubes that went into the major bones.
Right.
And so they were inflated with air throughout the life of the animal.
So they were sauropods.
Well, that was, you know, that was a reptilian adaptation that worked. Why not? Yeah. And, you know, they're big enough. So we've got these things, the big males are 22, 24 foot wingspread. You know, had bones that were strong enough to allow them to fly and get off the ground and probably fly for hours over the seaway.
Is there evidence of the skin flap between the finger bones and the legs?
Not with Pteranodon, but with other pterosaurs, yes. They've got preservation, particularly in Germany and the Sonthofen. Some indication that they were covered with fibrils.
Yeah.
Not feathers, but fibrils that may have some insulating characters or, you know, something we don't understand. But
sure.
But they weren't just bats, like bat wings, just pure layer of tissue. They actually had some covering.
I want to ask you real quick, just What's the coolest fossil you've ever found, Mike?
Oh, my.
What's the one that's like, you know, when your life is flashing before your eyes, it's going to be that one.
The coolest fossil I've ever worked with is a 4-foot-long Tylosaurus skull. Unfortunately, I didn't find it, but I went in. It was being poached, and I went in and helped the family get it out of the ground and get it prepared for the museum out at Oakley. So that's probably the coolest one, because that's got, as it turns out, it's published now, but it's got the complete scleral ring around the eyeball. And as I was preparing this thing, the eye was looking up at me. You know, it's kind of spooky a little bit there, but you can see exactly where the eyeball was in the living animal.
Did these marine reptiles have sclerotic rings like an ichthyosaur? The bony?
Yes, exactly.
The mosasaurs and tylosaurs and plesiosaurs all had that?
I don't know about plesiosaurs. I think they did, but I don't recall seeing any specimens with that preserved. Well, I do too. I take that back. Styxosaurus skull at KU has got part of the scleral ring in place, so it's good.
And so what is that about?
Yeah, what is that about, having a bone to focus the eye?
Well, was it for focusing or was it for protection against outside water pressure? I don't think anybody knows for sure.
Right.
But it continues into living animals today. Living lizards today have the same thing. So it may have been more of the Komodo dragon for one.
Right.
But yeah.
It's behind the eye. It supports the eye from behind, right?
No, it's within the eye.
No, it's actually in front. The eye is behind the ring. Yeah. It's complex. I don't know. If you look at a modern owl, the eyes of a modern owl, and you'll see the same structure, but it's in their case, it's probably part of the visual acuity, being able to focus. It apparently, these are overlapping plates. The scleral ring is composed of 14 or 15 plates to make the ring, and they flex between, so you get them sliding over one another a little bit to allow the opening to widen and close like that. So
I'm going to have to look into sclerotic rings a little bit and find out more about that.
You're going to look into them?
Yeah. The pun was, with me, it's always intended. Hey, Mike, it's been really fun talking, man, and I'm going to come find you at Derby, Kansas, because I've got a place in Lindsborg just up the road from
you.
We'll
come find you.
Yes, please do. Come see my Dakota sandstone. I want you to check it out. I bought beachfront property in Kansas, is what I like to say. But if you could go back in time, Mike, what exciting epoch, what perfect period, what exquisite era would you go back to, and what would you want to see?
You can't say late Cretaceous, because that's where you feel it. Come on, that's where you study.
That hurts. Okay.
Push back, Mike. Push back.
Well, eliminate the late Cretaceous. I would say the middle Jurassic, when we've got all kinds of other marine reptiles, the ichthyosaurs that were the fish lizards that were all over the world, the big pliosaurs, Liopleurodon, all kinds of other marine creatures that they're no longer around today, but that would have been a fantastic environment, including the ammonites and other giant shelled cephalopods.
Gotta see those
out there. So yeah, it would have been a fascinating place to observe. Although you probably wouldn't want to be swimming there because you're too late.
Let me just ask you this. Since we know you love the late Cretaceous and the Western Interior Seaway, you get to look at one creature alive. What is it in that ocean?
The boring Hesperonis.
No, I mean,
well,
you've thought a lot about these creatures. You've thought a lot about all these creatures.
Which is the last toothed bird.
It's one of the last toothed birds, yeah.
Okay.
The toothed birds would have been a very interesting observation, because you have Ichthyornis, which is small enough to fly and still has a mouthful of very sharp teeth. You've got Hesperornis, which is pretty much a late Cretaceous penguin, but he's swimming with his feet, not with his wings.
Right.
And I'd like to go back a little farther and figure out when Hesperornis lost their wings. Because, you know, we don't have any fossils from the early Cretaceous or late Jurassic that indicate an ancestor. But somewhere along the line, Hesperornis just gave up on flying
Does it fly through the water like a penguin?
No, a penguin actually uses its wings to fly through the water and doesn't use its feet. Hesperornis uses its feet and doesn't have any wings left. It's its upper limbo, and the humerus is, you know, toothpick about that long, and that's it. It would have, it may have supported, you know, a fleshy appendage, but it certainly wasn't useful for anything.
So I interrupted you. What would be the